Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 588 for Tuesday, the 18th of December. My name is Len Padilla, coming to you from Pamplona, Spain. Today, we've got a call with Matt Oxley to review the 2018 season, look forward to the 2019 season, and as always, when Matt and I get together, talk a little bit about politics. But first, let's catch up with Andy and see what he's got going on. Hey, Andrew, good day. How's it going?
Hey, it's good here. We've got some blue sky and sunshine, a little bit warmer than it has been. So, kind of promising, especially when I've been out dragging the dog around the fields for the past week or so. So, yeah, it's not so bad. How about you in Spain? I always think it's sunny Spain, but that's not necessarily the case in Pamplona, is it?
Oh, my God. Yesterday was quite a day. We were sitting in a restaurant that overlooks the city with some friends with big glass windows. So really, you know, really nice. And it was blue, sunny sky with puffy clouds, which was nice because it hasn't been like that lately. It's been raining a lot. So we were really enjoying. And then this micro front full of really active thunderstorms rolled in. And in the space of an hour, it started, you know, first the wind came up, then it was raining, then it was hailing, then it was blowing everything all around, and then it cleared up.
Yeah. So and the last time I think you and I got to speak on Motopod, you were just about to head off to Jerez.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it was that long ago. Yeah, so the trip to Jerez was, well, it was good. It's always good to ride motorcycles around a fantastic racetrack. The bad thing was it was a three-day event and two of the days it rained. So that was a real, real bummer.
Yeah, it's such a shame. You know, you think you go that far south that you're going to catch some decent weather. And typically when we've done it this time of year, we've generally been fairly fortunate.
So we've been very lucky.
20 degrees dry, at least. So, yeah, that's a real shame to lose those last few days, you know, that being the last track day of the season.
Yeah, it was too bad. And the worst of it was insult upon injury. The one day that was clear, it was still quite cold. And I destroyed a back tire in four sessions just because it was so cold. It was a soft tire, so it wouldn't hold up to the cold too well. Yeah. So I wasn't too happy about that either.
Oh, okay. Well, onwards and upwards, preparing for 2019. I think for me, probably the first dates will be February somewhere in southern Spain.
Yeah. I'm hoping to do the same. Maybe Valencia in early Spain. The weather's usually fairly predictable there. So yeah, maybe we'll try that.
Yeah, always bitch about that place being a tiny little car park. But if the weather's good, I'm happy to give it a spin.
Exactly. You know, I'm not quite at MotoGP speeds, so I think it's okay for me.
So one of the things I was excited to hear is that you've had a chance to sit down with Matt Oxley, the longtime MotoGP correspondent.
I did. You know, Matt's always a good one to talk to because he's got lots of insight. You know, he's a very, very old man, so he's been at it for a long time. And I think he was saying 32 years next year. I don't think there are many people with that kind of experience. Maybe even Matt Burt. Matt Burt hasn't been around it that long either.
Well, I always appreciate Matt because he actually did race at quite an impressive level as well. Yeah.
He did what's, I don't know if it was called the same thing back then, but he was big into endurance racing and the equivalent of world endurance. I don't know if they called it the same thing, but yeah, raced at a decent level, rode a lot of GP bikes in his days, and has a lot of good, you know, has good context to understand what's happening now.
Well, and I just had a recent reminder too that one of his jobs. And in some respects, you know, no insult to Matt, but it kind of shows his age, but it goes back to my teenage years, that he worked at Performance Bike, a long-time UK bike magazine that unfortunately has sort of, you know, fallen foul, I guess, of the winds of the internet, has now had to fold as a standalone publication and be wrapped into Practical Sports Bikes. But that was definitely a magazine of my sort of late teens, watching people like Matt and Rupert and Simon Hargreaves and people like that. I mean, for me, those were kind of teenage hooligans and inspirations.
Yeah, the same. I discovered all that stuff a little late living in the U.S., but occasionally would get my hands on an English bike mag, and they were so different than the magazines that we had in the States that it was very exotic and exciting reading, put it that way.
So there wasn't much news, realistically. I think after all the testing, everything's calmed down a little bit. But the only thing I did see that sort of caught my eye this sort of beginning week was Alberto Puig, it sounds like, has been sitting down with a few interviewers just mulling over some thoughts of past and future riders.
Yeah, I saw that as well. That was actually in La Vanguardia, a Barcelona-based newspaper. And all I could think as I was reading it was, why are you doing this? Because I can imagine if it were maybe if it's a current rider and you've got a beef against him, I don't see the real reason to take it up and run with it. But, you know, maybe somebody thinks that they can get some use out of it. But a rider who has retired, what's that going to get anybody? I don't really understand.
I don't know if this is still sort of a continuation of when they split as rider manager in 2013, end of 2013. I think, you know, I don't know if that's this is still sort of unfinished business that is, but quite wide want to launder your smalls in public like that at this time. Really don't see the point, the rhyme or the reason. And I think he also had some words for Rossi in there as well.
Yeah, he did, which, again, I just don't understand unless you think that you can benefit from stirring things up, which I think is questionable. It just, it's one of those things where I just don't really understand the motivation. So I don't think Alberto comes off really looking so good at after that. I think Danny handled it probably the best way. You know, he gave kind of a backhanded remark about, you know, you shouldn't talk about people that aren't talking about you, and left it at that.
Yeah.
But oh well.
I think just occasionally, you know, it's like these little moments that we see, that sort of simmering tension that I just guess is always in the paddock that, you know, we don't get to see because everything's filtered through, you know, corporate press releases and, you know, little media PR sit downs with, you know, the corporate sponsors and things. But it's, you know, like I say, I'd love people like Matt as an example, if at some point, once they're done, they could just imagine writing this little memoir. I think that would be a fascinating read.
I think the book that we want Matt to write would get him thrown out of MotoGP, so we'll probably have to wait.
I think you're right.
Well, with that, why don't we have a quick listen to Matt's chat with me earlier today and see what he has to say about next year or about last year, next year, and all things in between.
Cool.
Hello, Matt. How's it going?
Very good, Len. How are you?
I'm doing well. Getting ready for Christmas to start. I'm not very Christmassy, but I'm happy for a bit of a break.
Yeah, same. It's the holidays that mean stuff to me, yeah.
Yeah. It'll be right. nice to get away for a little while.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that brings us here, I was thinking of having a bit of a look back at 2018, and since you did something new this year, I thought you'd be the one to talk to. You've been involved in MotoGP so long that it's probably been a while since you've done something new around MotoGP.
Yeah. Last year was my 31st season, so and my first writing an annual. Yeah, so that was the new thing last year because Julian Ryder kind of went into semi-retirement at the end of 2017. So I was asked to take over his book, which is the kind of official book. And I'm actually really I was a bit scared, you know, as you always are when you've got 300 pages or 200 pages to fill or whatever. But no, I really enjoyed writing it, actually. Basically, it's a pretty straightforward 19 races, well, 19 rounds, let's say, not 19 races. We do even cover the Silverstone round and the travesty that was. But race by race, 8 pages a race, you know, lots of information and technical analyses of all the bikes and everything. And I just think it's MotoGP is in such an excellent place at the moment. You know, the racing's so good, the technology is so interesting because, you know, with the tires and electronics, the factories have to really, really work hard to get the maximum out of the bikes, you know, which is what you want to see. You want to see, you don't want them having an easy time. You know, you actually want them having quite a complicated, difficult time. And that's what brings out, you know, the best in the riders. And it's what brings out the best in the engineers as well, you know, which to me, that's basically all racing is about. It's about riders and engineers. You know, it's people and motorbikes, isn't it?
Definitely. Definitely. When you think about a 300-page book, I mean, initially when I think of something like that, it's really daunting. You think, oh my God, how am I ever gonna write so much? But I'll bet that when it comes to writing, you know, the year-end book about MotoGP, it probably quickly turns into how am I gonna get it down to 300 pages?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could just, I always thought, you know, that you could write, I always wanted to kind of write a story with a rider about a race. And I reckon, you know, if you were to spend all the weekend with that rider at that race, which will probably never happen, but you could probably write pretty much half a book. You know, if you were to go into every thought process he had from turning up at the circuit on Wednesday or Thursday till leaving the circuit and getting home on Monday or whatever, I reckon you could do 20,000 words, 30,000 words easily, you know, that would actually, that to me would be the only way of getting across to people not in racing how much goes into what they do. You know, it would literally be half a book in one race, you know. So yeah, getting a season down to 200 pages, whatever, is, yeah, it's, well, that's what your job is as a journalist, isn't it? It's to prioritize, work out what the story is for each race, and away you go, you know. It's, yeah, and once you got into the kind of rhythm of it, it actually all kind of fell into place quite nicely, yeah.
Yeah, well, I like that idea of the book describing the whole weekend process from one writer's perspective. Now that you've let that cat out of the bag, we'll be waiting for that.
Okay, all right, that will be the next one.
So yeah, so going back to the whole year in review that you wrote, without getting into 300 pages, what were the things that really jumped out at you? What really excited you? And maybe what even, you know, what disappointed you? What didn't turn out the way you thought?
What excited me was what I just said, really, that just the racing is so close. And I did a series of interviews with most of the top riders today on this year on how their riding technique has sort of developed over the last few years. And that was kind of my own personal highlight of the year, was doing those sort of interviews with all the top guys, which are now kind of, there's quite a bit of them in the book scattered around. But I'm now kind of doing a series of blogs just with the full Q&As, which is the wonder of the internet. You know, you don't have to cram it into any space. You know, right. If you're writing a story for a magazine and you interview Jorge Lorenzo about his riding technique, you'll have 400 words, you know, and you've got to cram it into there. So you've got to prioritize. But if you do the Q&A, which is 1500 words, you know, to me, it's 10 times better than the 400 words, you know, because you really, with the Q&A, you really get the feel of what the guy's saying or what he's trying to get across, and really the kind of little nuances about riding technique and how it's developing all the time, and how they just never stop working on it now. You know, it's not like it was 10, 20 years ago where they just went out and rode. You know, every race they're trying to work out, you know, how they're going to find that extra thousands by modifying a line here or a line there or body position on the bike and so on and so forth, you know.
Yeah, I read the one that you had in Motorsport about with Andrea Dovizioso, and it was pretty interesting. It's amazing to see the, not just how hard they try, because they all try hard, whether they're thinking or not, they all try hard, but how hard he's thinking about it.
Yeah, I think now, you know, as the racing gets closer and closer and closer and more technical, you know, just talent is just, you always needed talent, but that's just, and it's still a, you know, a vital part of it. But wow, you just having that talent is not enough anymore. You've got to be able to develop the talent constantly. Race by race, corner by corner, you know, and you've got to think all the time. They never stop. I mean, I think now, you know, 10, 20 years ago, I think it would have been a fun job being a MotoGP rider. But now I just think, wow, it's just too intense. Just they earn every penny, you know.
Yeah.
They earn every penny.
Yeah, I remember years and years ago reading, I think it was Jeremy Burgess that said that what he thought Valentino Rossi's advantage was at the time, and I think this is going back to the early 2000s, was basically his ability to quickly process information. You know, he thought that he was really good as both as a sensor and as a processing unit. And I'm wondering, is it a situation where basically everybody's caught up and everybody's working at that same level, and that's not, you know, a differentiator, or do some writers still have that over others, do you think?
I think, well, look at the top three in the championship. Marquez, Dovizioso, Rossi, all hugely intelligent and incredibly quick in their brains. I mean, you know, interviewing people face to face, you get a very quick, very good idea of how bright they are, how intelligent they are, how good they are at processing information, how good they are at giving feedback. You know, you really get that. And now it's the clever guys that really, you know, you've got to be talented, as I say. But I would say those three probably stand out. I would say Rins as well, very bright and very kind of methodical. Vinales, obviously hugely talented, but I think he's a bit more kind of, his head's a bit all over the place, you know, which is something he needs to work on. So I'm just going through the top five of the championship there. So four of the top five I would put as down as very, very intelligent people, you know, and that's not a coincidence that they're all at the very, very intelligent ones are at the top. Lorenzo as well, highly intelligent, very good at. I think that was probably my highlight of this year, actually, was watching Lorenzo start winning on the Ducati and start changing as a human being. He really changed this year. You know, I've always found him a little bit difficult to get on with, but he seemed to really mature in one big step. I think he suffered so badly at the beginning of the year. I think he grew up a lot as a result of that. You know, losing makes you stronger. I think that was possibly my highlight of the year, actually, just watching Jorge sort of change, you know. Just sad that it all went pear-shaped for him, that's all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about that specifically, actually, because it seems like one of the big highlights of the year was, you know, halfway through, Jorge figuring out, or, you know, it's not all him, it's him and the team figuring out how to make the right combination. It all started working. And then I think the cherry on top was how well he's been doing with the Honda since then. He seems to have completely transformed from a one-trick pony into somebody who could ride all three of those bikes amazingly well.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, to do what he did on the Ducati was special. I mean, he chose a better time to go to Ducati than Rossi did.
Yeah,
but, definitely. You know, at the same time, making your choices at the right time is part of what racing is about. You know, that is part of being good and is taking, you know, seeing an opportunity and taking it, not taking the right opportunity at the wrong time or taking the wrong opportunity at the right time. You know, it's a really tricky, all the way through your career, it's about how you're hooking up with the different technologies, you know, and he chose the right time to hook up with the Ducati. And for sure, without a doubt, the Ducati is a lot further away from the Yamaha than the Honda is. So when people were saying, oh, he won't be able to ride the Honda, I was like, wow, you know, he can ride the Ducati. Of course he'll be able to ride the Honda. You know, I mean, look at Pedrosa. You know, people said, oh, Marquez, da-da-da. Pedrosa was brilliant on the Honda. He struggled because of control tires with the Bridgestones a lot. And then he struggled a lot more with control electronics and Michelins because, you know, the sort of sweet spot for the motorcycle got narrower and narrower and narrower. And he's just too small to
outside
fit
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Or to get the bike in there, you know? So, if he was just out of it, then there's no way that Jorge wasn't going to be able to ride the bike smoothly. You know, he can ride it like Danny, but he's 14 kilos heavier, I think, which is a crucial difference, and bigger as well.
Yeah. Big
crucial
difference. He's a bit taller. He's a bit stronger.
Yeah. He can move around the bike. He can transfer load, he can move inside the bike, he can move over the front of the bike, you know, blah blah blah. So which kind of takes us on to next year, which, you know, obviously the story of next year from where we're sat now is Marquez versus Lorenzo, which I just cannot wait for. You know, I think, well, I've said it a few times already. To me, it's kind of Senna and Prost all over again.
Yep.
You know, you've got the two best riders in the best team. And that doesn't happen.
Yeah, the two best riders in the best team, but very different people. And like you said, you know, Jorge seems to have matured a bit. You know, I don't know him, but from the outside, seems to have a bit. But next year is going to be the real test because he'll have ample opportunities to stick his foot in his mouth, and it'll be interesting to see if he avoids that.
Yeah, I think he will. I think he will. Well, it's too early to say, but I think he's a very different person from what he was a year or two ago, you know.
Seems like it.
But it's going to be interesting. You know, pressure can do strange things to people, and it's going to be interesting to see how he gets on. It's going to be a pressure cooker in the Repsol Honda pit, you know, which is going to be fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see how Jorge deals with it, how Mark deals with it, how the team deals with it.
After this past weekend, I'll be interested to see how Alberto Puig deals with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I always think in racing that the best team managers are ex-racers, you know, because they're the only ones who can really understand what a rider goes through, what a rider needs to do and what he doesn't. You know, I would say, look at David Tardozzi, Ducati. He's fantastic. You know, I think if Ducati had allowed him to go to MotoGP with Troy Bayliss, which is what Bayliss wanted, then I think Bayliss, he might not have won the title, but he would have been way more successful than he was. You know, as soon as they let, when they asked Bayliss to ride that bike at Valencia, you know, one of his things was, right, I'm bringing Tardozzi and my crew chiefs with me.
And it
worked. What he wanted. And he went straight out and won the race, you know. And that's not a pure coincidence. So Puig says what he thinks. And, you know, to me, a lot of team managers are politicians. He's a racer.
Oh, he's certainly not. Certainly not the go he had at Denny this weekend.
Yeah, he's a racer. You know, he just, bang, he's going to do whatever he can do to win the race, you know, nothing else. And,
but I think he'll also go out there and say things when there is no benefit from saying it, which is what I think he did this weekend.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of don't particularly get off on the he said, she said kind of stuff, you know. I know a lot of people do, but it's a very, you know, motorbike racing is a very competitive, very vicious world, and most people, it's much more vicious than most people understand. So when people say that kind of stuff, it doesn't bother me at all. You know,
right.
it's just nothing compared to kind of biting chunks out of each other on the racetrack, you know?
True. So one of the things when we were talking about the, you know, the top riders, their ability to analyze and to perceive, you mentioned a couple of them there together, you know, specifically Mark and Valentino. And one thing I've been wondering, I mean, a long time now, people have been talking the GOAT debate. Is he or isn't he? You know, Valentino. And then they have to dredge up all the old riders and can you compare them? Can you not compare them? And I don't often hear people say it about Mark. And I'll be honest, I wonder why. Because he's so young, he's done so much, and we've seen what he can do if he keeps doing it. I just wonder if he's not going to, you know, is this the year that he really begins to, I don't want to say eclipse Valentino, but maybe just start reaching those same levels as far as, you know, records and recognition?
Well, to me, from a racing results point of view, he's kind of already up there. You know, I mean, the whole GOAT thing, you know, it's
impossible.
It's impossible. You know, you can say what you like, but it's impossible. But I mean, from a point of view, from a rider who's ridden lots of different kinds of bikes, has been winning for over, well, how long? 20 years. Been winning races for 20 years. No one else has done that. He's done it on 125s, 250s, 500s, 990s, 800s, 1000s. From all those points of view, you'd have to go, well, yeah, no one has done that.
Right.
You know, what he's done is completely unique. Does that make him the best rider ever? I don't know. But what he's done is completely unique.
Right. And I'm thinking more about that part, the what he's done rather than the just the writing, because it seems like, you know, Valentino came in a lot of ways changed the sport in terms of recognition, in terms of the, you know, the level that he brought to it, the domination that he brought to it. I wonder if Mark isn't sort of doing not those same things, but similar things. You know, the way he approaches racing seems to be a bit different than almost everybody out there. You know, he's the only one that's out there crashing his brains out all weekend and then winning the races. And he's been doing that for several years now. And you just wonder, how long does that continue?
Yeah, well, there's kind of reasons for that. You know, it's the Honda needs a hard front tire. It's harder to control a slide on the front tire, on a hard front tire. That's, I think, one of the main reasons he crashes a lot. You know, he's using the hard tires in the race, and he's quite often using them in practice as well, because, you know, obviously you've got to practice with what you're going to race. So, and that's Honda's big thing for next year. It is trying to sort out the front end of that bike so they can run a softer front tire. You know, Mark will never be a Rossi. You know, Rossi just had that kind of crossover persona where people who have no interest in motorbikes have kind of got into it. So yeah, he's also unique from that point of view. Mark, I think, is a similar personality, very bubbly, very fun-loving. I mean, he reminds me of Rossi when Rossi was 25. You know, everything was fun. All he ever did was laugh. You know, you see him, he always eats with his team lunchtime and in the evenings, and he's always the kind of center of the part, you know, life and soul of the party, laughing and blah blah blah, you know. So I think they're similar in many ways. It's just kind of unfortunate that they don't see eye to eye. I mean, that, you know, opposites attract and all that, I don't know. But also last season Mark became the, you know, took Rossi's record of the youngest guy to win 5 Premier Class world titles. He took that from Rossi. That's quite a significant achievement, I think. You know, without a doubt, Marquez, Rossi, Kenny Roberts, Casey Stoner, Ago. I mean, you just go on and on. I think if you ask me for my GOAT, I would have to give you 10 names.
Right.
Of which anyone could be or might not be. I don't know, you know.
Yeah. It's like we said, it's an impossible task.
Yeah. Yeah.
So besides the top two guys, besides Valentino and Mark, looking at the things that were, you know, standing out last year that we're looking forward to next year, there's a couple that I wonder about, and some of them are more factories than riders. I think the obvious one is KTM. You know, KTM created a lot of expectation with how well they did the first year. This year was good but not great, and that's probably just because the last 2% are a lot harder than the first 98. And what do you think, or what do you realistically expect from them in 2019?
Next year, the big thing to remember about KTM last season is that they were just, Paul Espargaró, their lead rider, was just basically injured most of the year. You know, he did his back very badly at Sepang, didn't he, during the preseason tests. He went really fast in the first 2 days. I can't remember where he was, but he was right up there, then had a huge crash on the last day, and he needed spinal surgery on it. You know, he needed surgery on his back, which is pretty major. Maybe not on the spine, but it was, I can't remember exactly what he did, but it was major surgery. And pretty much as soon as he wasn't fit until Mugello. And then where did he crash? He crashed shortly after that, broke his collarbone. And then when he came back, crashed and rebroke the collarbone. So basically, their lead rider was unfit for most of the year. I think that was one of the reasons they kind of stalled. And, you know, when you see Zarco get on the bike, wow, I mean, his body language at the tests at Jerez and Valencia was, not good.
Yeah, it looked, you know, like Rossi in 2011.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was like, oh my God. So this is, you know, I think, and not so much, but also, you know, Lorenzo, when he went to Ducati, you know, you've come off the Yamaha, which is a, you know, it may not be the winning bike at the moment, but it's a lovely, easy, friendly motorcycle. You know, it's the friendliest, easiest of all of them, possibly apart from the Suzuki. And, you know, the KTM is kind of a Honda, basically. It's a 90-degree V4 like the Honda. And you just look at the KTM from this, and it just looks like a Honda. Well, you know, half
not surprising
their engineers,
with the people
yeah,
that are
half
over
their
there.
Engineers have come from Honda, you know. So it's not an easy ride, but if you work out how to ride it, it will do the lap time. You know, you've just got to really... It's that same Honda thing, always was, you know, with the NSR 500 and everything. You've got to grab it by its horns and ride the thing, you know.
Well, and that seems to be the way that Paul Espargaró likes to ride. So maybe that's going to work for him next year when he's fit.
Exactly. I mean, he's a great guy, Paul. And yeah, I hope he sort of, yeah, they take another step. But like you say, the first 98% are easier than the last 2%. And you know, you think how much know-how Honda and Yamaha and everyone else has got, Ducati, KTM have nothing, basically.
Right.
Have, you know, two seasons. You know, Honda have been doing this since 1966. You know, Yamaha have been doing it since 1973. Suzuki since 1973. Ducati since 2003. You know, it's not easy.
Yeah, and then you've got a factory that has done it all in other championships, seems to know what it takes, but can never quite put it together. What's going on with Aprilia? I mean, why? It's easy to sort of point at them and say, oh, it's, you know, it's just resources. They don't bring enough to the track. They don't have a big enough organization. But it just, they seem to get really close.
They were pretty good in 2017, and, yep. And they made the mistake of redesigning the bike for 2018, and they just got it all wrong. And it wasn't until they kind of labored along trying to fix it. I think at middle of the season, they were thinking of going back to the old bike, but decided not to. And then suddenly at the end of the year, when they kind of brought out this hybrid bike, which is some 2017 right. parts, some 2018 parts, some new for 19 parts, the bike suddenly got a lot better. So I think they just went down a wrong turning last season. They changed the whole way the bike loads the tires and everything. And Espargaró couldn't get heat into the tires. Alesh couldn't get heat into the tires. So I think they're going to take a step back, and which will hopefully take them forward into next year. So I think KTM, their 2018 was kind of messed up by injury. Aprilia's was messed up by, you know, making the mistake of redesigning the motorcycle, you know. Whereas nowadays, generally, I mean, you look at Honda, you look at Yamaha, you look at Ducati, although they're trying lots of new stuff all the time, basically, it's just a tweak here, a tweak there, a tweak here, you know. And Ducati are particularly good at with bolt-ons. You know, they kind of stuck the wings on and off they went. And the parallelogram rear end that they used at the last test was very interesting, you know.
I was just going to ask you about that. If you got any information about, you know, why it is that they've decided to try something like that, did they really get anything out of it? Because it sounds like a couple of riders made their fastest lap with it, but yeah. weren't ready to really give it credit for the fast lap.
Exactly. But well, the basic thing is that when you brake, it squats the rear end. So therefore, instead of the bike pitching forward completely, it squats the rear end to give you better grip during braking with the rear tire, which is the most important thing now, because with the Bridgestones, you did all your braking with the front. The back wheel was generally in the air. With the Michelins, so it did, you know, you couldn't use the brake because the wheel was in the air. With the Michelins, the front, they're on the limit. They're locking the front on the brakes at 200 miles an hour, you know, and then managing
great.
That. Yeah. And they're managing that locking with their fingers. So all the way from 220 miles an hour or whatever at Mugello, they're locking, releasing, locking, releasing, locking, releasing, locking, releasing, which, you know, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. So if you can get some more power from the rear end to brake, you're going to have a big advantage. That's basically what that's all about. And I think if it works, which it obviously does, because the very first day, Dovizioso and Petrucci tried it, and Miller, they were all like, wow, you know, this is great. You know, it makes the rear much more stable, you know, because it makes keeps the rear in contact with the ground, you know. So it's one of those things where if it does work, they'll start appearing on all the bikes, you know, just like wings did, you know.
Right. I was just thinking the same thing. It'll be just like the wings. All of a sudden, they'll start popping up everywhere.
Exactly. Exactly.
So any other standout things that you're looking for from 2019? Anything that you think that we might see that might make things more interesting, that'll change things up?
Well, I mean, you'd have to hope that Yamaha will finally dig themselves out of a hole, having finally worked out what their problem was, i.e. the engine, not the electronics. And I think Suzuki as well, I think they'll take another step up, which will be great. You know, I think considering that they don't have a lot of resources, you think of resource-wise, the three factories that have the most are Honda, Ducati, Yamaha, then a quite a big drop to Suzuki, KTM, and Aprilia. And I'd say that KTM probably put more into it than Suzuki do money-wise. And they've obviously got Red Bull helping them a lot. So I think Suzuki do a great job, and I think the GSX RR is a beautiful little bike. You know, ever since it arrived in 2015, just a really, really nicely put together package, you know, which is what it's all about, is getting the package right, you know. It's not about having the fastest engine or the best chassis or anything. It's having the best bike where everything kind of works together, you know.
Right. Well, hopefully the entire MotoGP 2019 package works well together. I think it does. Like you were saying earlier, the greatest thing about the racing now is just how close it is, how on any day you've got so many different riders that, you know, that might actually be able to put it together and do it. I think that's going to be really interesting next year. But I'm wondering about a couple of other series as well. One that I don't expect a lot from, and one that I'm hopeful. So first, Moto2. I'm not a person that thinks that changing the layout of the engine is going to make a massive difference. I mean, yeah, it's going to have a little more power, probably significantly more torque. But what am I missing? Is there something more there?
Well, if you've got more torque, it makes, and whenever people talk about it making the bike easier to ride, it doesn't mean that the riders are kind of sitting back having a coffee while they're riding it. It means better to take to the limit, you know, more people will be able to take it to the limit. So the Triumph engine should make the bikes easier to ride because it's got more torque. So they won't be having to use corner speed so much. They can get it into the corner, pick it up, and use the torque to get out. And generally, that makes the racing closer because when it's corner speed only, there's only one way to ride the bike. If you've got torque, you can still ride it with corner speed if you want, but it just gives you more options as a rider. And that means it'll fit more riders, should allow more riders to go fast. I think to start off with, it'll probably be like Moto 2 was at the beginning, where it was kind of pretty chaotic in a good way, you know.
That sounds good.
I think it'll make the racing better. But, you know, motorbikes are very strange things. I could be completely wrong.
Right. Well, we shall see. And then the other series that I'm interested in and interested to get your take, because I think you are probably, and try to take this nicely, I don't mean this badly, you're the oldest, I'm going to say some more nice things after this, you're the oldest, most sort of normal conservative motorcyclist that actually likes electric bikes.
Well,
maybe not for racing, but I know that your experience with electric bikes has been positive and you've always said really good things about them. What do you think about the electric racing bikes?
I mean, it's something that's got to happen, basically. You know, you look at Formula One and Formula E, there's more money going into the manufacturers are putting more money into Formula E than they do into Formula One now. You know, I'm not trying to judge whether it's the right way to go or whatever, but it's, you know, the world is what it is, and you've got to kind of go with it. Hence the need for a MotoGP electric series. I mean, and it's baby steps. You know, they're doing it in the cheapest way possible with a control bike. Everybody's got the same bike because they know that if they went to a kind of open series, they'd have Mugen in there lapping everybody.
Right.
After three laps. You know. So that's their way of making the racing better, you know. So in 5 years, 10 years, I think it could be really good, you know. It's new technology. A lot of people don't let, you know, same when motor cars and motorbikes replace horses. A lot of people really hated that, you know, and so, you know, it's just pointless trying to, you know, be King Canute and kind of sort of try and wave away the new technology and say, it's, you know, the tide's not going to come in. The tide always comes in.
Oh, yeah,
Things always change.
It's definitely you know, coming.
We're only here for a little, we're all just a blip, aren't we? You know, in the history of the world, with all tiny little blips. And most of us don't like it when change happens, but change has always happened, you know. It never doesn't happen. We all just go through a little purple patch of our lives when we think that this is really cool. In our 20s and 30s, this is cool, and you expect it to stay the same forever, but it never does, you know. That'd be same for any generation, you know. So yeah, I'm into it. I see what it brings, you know. It might be rubbish, it might be brilliant, who knows. I mean, you know, the only thing that concerns me is the weight of the bikes.
Yep.
270 kilos.
It'll be a scary pileup when it happens.
Yeah, you wouldn't want one of them landing on you. But you know, it's like I say, it's early days. It's early days. It's got to start somewhere. You know, you have to start the ball rolling at some point, and they've decided to do it now. And you know, 5 years, 10 years from now, who knows? It might, you know, it might end up bigger than MotoGP. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like change. I thrive on chaos. I get bored if it doesn't change too much. And I can't wait for the electric bikes to completely take over. The weight is what kills me right now. It's why I don't have one. It's why I still have a gasoline-powered track bike. But I fast forward 15, 20 years, and unfortunately, I won't be riding on the track anymore, probably. But imagine having a bike with, you know, the characteristics that the electric bikes have, with the power that they have, and imagine them even at the same weight of yeah, gasoline bikes now.
Yeah.
And that'd absolutely just be something really special.
Yeah. I mean, I've only ridden one on the road, and in London, they're just awesome. You know, just instant torque, no gears. You just couldn't imagine a better kind of power delivery, basically, or transmission. It's just kind of, you stick the thing in sport mode and it actually makes you laugh, you know,
yeah,
when you go away from the lights. And they get a lot of people crashing them as well, because they've got so much torque. If you've got them on sport mode, you open the throttle at a standstill or from walking pace, and people spin the rear tire and fall off.
Yeah, they'll catch you by surprise.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a good thing to me. You know, it shows how much torque they've got, you know, and just people are being caught out by how powerful they are. You know, because, you know, we all open the throttle and wait for the revs to build up,
yep,
you know, and we're not used to like opening the throttle and bang, full torque there. So, you know, and that's only a good thing. It's only a good thing, you know.
I can't wait. Bring on our electric overloads.
Yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned people being old and cranky and not liking change, and then the horseless carriage came along, and that reminded me of your latest book your penultimate book, I think, that I just finished reading, which was the Speed book.
Yeah.
And I this wasn't supposed to be me just telling you how great you are, but I really liked it. I really enjoyed the book. I think we talked about that. But there was a part of it that, there were parts of it that I expected to like. The human stories were fantastic. The part about the tie-in with aviation, I didn't expect, and I really, really liked that. Having been a pilot in the past, I was really excited to see sort of the concurrent technological development of the early aviation.
Back then, it was a very small, the kind of internal combustion world was a very small world, and basically all the engines were the same, weren't they? You know,
yep,
whether it was a car, a motorbike, or a plane, the engines were the same. And that's why in the First World War, an awful lot of fighter pilots were, well, nearly all of them were either car people or bike people. Because, you know, if you could work a motorcycle engine, then you could fly a plane.
Yeah.
It was pretty much as simple as that. You know, it was, you just had a tiller instead of handlebars. That was about the only difference. And the ground was a bit further away, you know.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
But the thing that really got me was, and it's probably the, you know, the darker side of the book, the tie-in basically between, well, between motorsports, all sport in general, but motorsports is what this book is about, and sort of it being used as a fascist propaganda tool.
Yeah.
And it, it wasn't surprising because I think we've all read stories about that having happened back during, you know, end of World War One toward World War Two. A lot of disturbing parallels to, you know, to things that we might see now. But more than the political parallels, what it reminded me of was, and I'll use myself as a case study. You know, I'm super into bikes. I love bike racing. I love the things that make it happen, but it seems that there are a lot of unsavory things that keep it going that we're all willing to just sort of turn a blind eye to. And that bothers me about myself.
Yeah. 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 Well, fascism and tobacco aren't the same at all, but you know,
not quite.
Just going back to the tobacco sponsorship days. I always remember Kaczynski, John Kaczynski, who was won the 250 world title in 1990 and, you know, was going to be King Kenny's next big thing at Marlborough Team Roberts when he came to 500s and everything in 91. I remember being at a Marlborough Yamaha press conference and Kaczynski came in late, as always, and refused to sit down until everybody had stopped smoking. So that kind of, you know, he was happy to take their money because it allowed him to race motorbikes and earn good money out of racing motorbikes. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, he hated it at the same time. So, like I say, I'm not trying to liken Kaczynski riding for Marlboro Yamaha to Ernst Henne riding for a Nazi-sponsored BMW. But, you know, there's a kind of correlation there, really, you know, that kind of thing of going, well, you know what, I want to race motorbikes and I don't really care about anything else, you know.
Yeah. And it's not just the racers. I think it's us that watch it as well. I remember several years ago in the UK there was a big uproar about some of the, you know, some big corporates not paying their fair share of tax, and I think people were really hammering on Amazon, Starbucks, and some other, you know, multinational companies.
Yeah.
You know, justifiably, you know, all had good points. But you'll have a hard time finding a motorcycle fan that will take a top racer to task for living in a fiscal paradise and not paying the taxes that make the roads work and, you know, and the NHS spin along.
I'm not going to be able to work in the paddock after this. Yeah, it's a tricky one. My wife is a nurse, so I think I kind of put it to her. Well, I said, look, you know, it's not so bad. These guys sort of, you know, they've got very short careers, blah, blah, blah. You know, so, you know, it's surely all not that bad that they put their money in a tax haven. And she's like, I earn 19 grand a year saving people's lives. Piss off, basically.
Yeah.
You know? And I pay all my tax. You know, I'm never going to get as rich as they are in a million years. And I'm saving people's lives. They're riding around in circles, you know, not doing anything but particularly useful. So yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one to get onto, but everyone does it, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's it. And we all keep it going. Like I said, I'm certainly not thinking that I'm above it or past it or have it figured out. It makes me wonder a lot of things about myself. But I have to say, I think what ends up pulling me out of it, sort of pulling me out of that despair, is the video that you tweeted today was a great example. Those kids racing around in Colombia, you know, a street race.
Yeah.
And it made me think that, you know, the racing will still be racing when all the money falls away.
Exactly.
And even if it were cleaned up and there were really low level racing is all that was left because there wasn't either energy drink money or oligarch money or whatever money, you know, being pumped into it. And I really liked what you said about, well, JB's quote, and I can't quite bring it up now, but go ahead and share with us what it was.
Jeremy Burgess, Rossi's old crew chief, he said that said to me once, I can't remember what we were talking about. He said, all you need for a motorbike race is one motorbike, two people and a stopwatch. And that's totally true. And people say, oh, you know, the racing always gets better with more money. You know, we need more money in the sport to make the racing better. That's nonsense. You know,
it gets faster, money, but not necessarily
more money
better.
Doesn't mean better racing. You know, racing is racing, and you know, it's a complicated thing, but I love it at its basic level. You know, like watching those street races in Colombia, I love that kind of stuff where all you know, it's literally down to a load of people who've got bugger all money, basically. They're not, you can see that none of them have got any money, and they've kind of sort of welded together a motorbike, and they go and race it, you know, and it will always be there. That will always be there. It'll never go away. And you know, I'd always encourage people to go and watch club racing, you know, go to support your local club races. It costs like a tenner to get in. You can go into the paddock, talk to people. The racing is normally excellent. You know, it doesn't need to be all glitzy and glossy and famous people and, you know, the kind of grassroots stuff is really, really nice, you know.
And I think that's what's really nice about motorcycle racing, even at the high level. I know Dorna went through a phase of trying to make it Formula One.
Yeah.
But what they didn't quite recognize is that the motorcycle is the vehicle of the poor. You know, those aren't the people that are yachting and watching Formula One and going to Ascot and going to Henley. It's a different crowd that they need to appeal to. And still some of them have money and they can pay for VIP passes and all of that. And it's not cheap to go to the MotoGP races, but it is fundamentally a different thing.
Yeah. It's not Formula One or Wimbledon or Ascot. It's a different vibe. And that's one reason I love it, you know, because it's kind of normal people. There's very little. And then going back to the money, whenever all I've ever noticed, you know, in 32 years doing it, next year will be my 32nd. So every time there's a bit of money comes into the sport, basically all you end up with is more management types, more PR people, and a few more celebrities. You know, actually, that's all that the money brings. You know, that seems to be the only change I've ever noticed is that, and maybe a few more TV stations with good looking presenters of male or female, you know, that's what the money does. The money doesn't actually make it any better, you know, in any true way. If you're actually into motorbikes and motorbike racing, the money doesn't make it any better. You know, we all like money, you know, it's useful. You know, the last thing I'd want motorbike racing to become, MotoGP to become, is like Formula One. I'd just hate that. I'd be out of there in a shot. You know, I just wouldn't like it.
Well, luckily, it doesn't look like it's in danger of doing that anytime soon, hopefully. And like you were saying earlier, looks like we're in for some pretty good racing next year, some really interesting things that are happening in terms of where the sport is going. And great characters, which at the end of the day is probably what it's really all about.
Yeah. I think we're incredibly lucky. The rainbow of characters that we've got, the machinery, the racing. We're just, you know, if you don't think we're in a golden age, then you really need to. I'd liken where we are now to Schwantz, Rainey, Lawson, Dew, and Gardner, five guys, late 80s, early 90s. We're kind of back there again, but even better.
I was just going to say, and even better, because we remember the good parts of that era, but what we don't remember, and I do, is 13 bikes on the grid.
Well, and also people getting horrendously injured.
That,
you know,
too, yeah.
I mean, you know, Doohan, Schwantz, Rainey, they all ended their careers injured. The year that Rainey was put in a wheelchair, you know, Corrado Catalano had massive smash at Hockenheim, still, you know, head injuries that still affect him to this day. That kind of stuff was just pretty much normal, you know. So to get rid of that, not entirely. I mean, that's the thing, that the racing is so close now that it's, that is a danger in itself, you know, and I think a lot of people don't understand that. like when BT Sport kind of put the Zarco crash up there, you know, the Zarco is one of their top crashes of the year. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, do you remember Simoncelli and Tomazawa?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it was a blink of an eye away from that.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it's just not something to be talked about. Like, you know, we all like to watch a crash where nobody gets hurt and it's, you know, and there's nobody likely to get hurt. You know, you see somebody fall off, blah, blah, blah. It can be amusing or interesting or exciting or titillating or whatever. But when that kind of thing happens, you're just going, oh, my God, you know, this guy, if Zarco had gone right instead of left, he probably wouldn't be here anymore, you know?
Yeah.
It's not something to laugh about, really.
Well, luckily that all worked out. We ended the season nicely, and now we'll slide into a couple of months of darkness and then come up for air in Sepang and see how it all goes for next year. So any interesting plans for you? Are you off to deepest, darkest Wales for winter?
No, just kind of just keeping it pretty quiet, really. Yeah, just going to do nothing, basically. Just sit around and have fun with the family, really. That's the plan.
Sounds great. Well, I imagine Christmas at your place is still very exciting, having two little kids.
Exciting for them.
Well, exactly. And it's your job to make it exciting for them.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's good. It's funny. What funny.
Yeah.
It's all good. It's all good.
All right. Well, thanks for taking the time. I hope you enjoyed it as well as I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy it.
Yeah, great. It's great to chat as always.
Great. And we will catch up soon.
Yeah. Cheers, Len.
Talk to you later.
Cheers, Len. Bye-bye.
Fun to talk to Matt like it always is. And some really interesting things. Obviously, you know, having talked about the things that already happened are always interesting, but the looking forward is what I liked hearing from him, specifically about Moto 2, the e-bikes, things like that.
Yeah, it was interesting him talking about the e-bikes, because that for us is a complete unknown for next year. I think, you know, Moto 2, to a degree, there's going to be some change, but, you know, it's largely the same riders on highly similar bikes in pretty much the same teams, but the e-bikes is really a new dimension and is completely new. But one of the things I'm not clear on is if those races will be televised, even on the MotoGP website through the video pass. Do you know?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I certainly hope so. I'm super interested in watching them. I just hope that they find the place to squeeze them in.
Because it's pretty short. It's only, what, a 5-lap?
Yeah, something like that. I think five laps.
I wondered if that will be part of the build-up to the MotoGP. You know, they could kind of put it in there. I just would have thought, you know, as they've got a fairly large major sponsor, they're going to want some visibility for this. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it goes.
But
the bike's been the same too. And it's odd. It was really, were you surprised to see names like Seti Gimenao come back to do this round?
If Sete hadn't already done a few failed comebacks, I would have been surprised. I was probably a little more dismayed than surprised, just thinking, why are you doing this?
That was a real surprise. Like, if someone had said, you know, guesstimate who you might think would be on the Moto E bikes, that was not one name I would have picked out the hat.
Yeah, because me, the e-bikes are all about, you know, looking toward the future. It's the new thing. It's probably not ready yet, but, you know, this is where things are going. And to really hammer that point home, we're going to bring riders back from retirement. I don't get it.
I get the fact that it's a new series and you want to sort of promote it with some sort of home brand names. You know, Bradley Smith, I think, was definitely a bit of a coup.
Yep.
In some respects, and it helps Bradley stay in and around the paddock. It was surprising seeing some of the other names in there. But I'm looking forward to watching those first few rounds. I'm going to really try and go in with a completely open mind. It'll be fun to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, it'll be good. I'll have my fingers crossed that they don't run into each other since they weigh so much. But I'm super excited about the e-bikes. I can't wait.
Well, a huge thank you to Matt Oxley for donating some of his time. I would have imagined, you know, with all the traveling and all the reporting he's done this year, plus, you know, the race to get the MotoGP review book out and in the shops before Christmas. I'm sure there was probably some other MotoGP season year roundup interviews. He must have been completely frazzled. I'm sure he's looking forward to a bike-free break now.
Yeah. That's one thing he said after we stopped recording was that he's very ready to just find somewhere to lie horizontally and still for a while.
I can imagine. Well, Len, thank you too for giving up your time as well. And yeah, just getting this out. I think that's a nice little Christmas treat to roll us into the Christmas holidays.
And speaking of Christmas treats, we've got a great one for all the fantastic people that have supported our show. As our way of saying thanks, we're putting the names of all of our show supporters into a hat, and we'll draw a name for a special prize. An autographed copy of Matt Oxley's latest, greatest book, Speed, the One Genuinely Modern Pleasure. As I mentioned earlier in the show, I really like this book, and if you like bikes, I think you'll like it too. If you haven't donated to our show yet, there is still time. Go to motopodcast.com, click on one of the donation links on the left side of the page, and make a donation before the end of the year. That'll put your name in the hat along with all the great people that have donated to us in 2018. Ho, 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 Merry Christmas and all of that. And there will probably not be weekly shows for the rest of the winter until things start happening, until there's something to actually talk about. But we hope you all have a very nice Christmas, Hanukkah, whatever it is that you celebrate. Have a great time with it. Tell the people that you love them, and enjoy the time off.
Absolutely. And the same goes to you as well, Len. Thanks.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Cheers. Bye.